You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Coming up, African-American women and Latinas are getting lower quality cervical cancer treatment than white women, according to new research. We found out why and what can be done.
First, what makes something popular? In today's world, where we're surrounded by a pretty much infinite amount of products, ideas, services, songs, entertainment options, why do some things rise to the top and become cultural phenomena and others just remain in obscurity?
Our next guest wanted to answer these questions, and while it seems like it's all luck, it turns out that's not the case. From memes to music videos, there's a lot going on behind the scenes designed to grab our attention and influence our behavior. And as humans, we tend to go for it time and time again.
Derek Thompson joins us now. He's a senior editor at The Atlantic, where he writes about economics and the media. He's the author of the new book, Hitmakers, The Science of Popularity in an Age of Distraction. Derek, welcome back to Central Time.
Hey, it's great to be back. Thank you.
So as we said, your book is trying to tackle this big question of what makes a thing popular. And you're talking movies, products, pop culture, songs. And you call this a science. Why?
Yeah, you know, it's interesting because on the one hand, I think pop culture is sort of inherently sentimental. People feel really emotionally about their favorite songs and their favorite movies and television shows. And, you know, I write about economics at The Atlantic, and economics is a really unsentimental industry. It's numbers. It's a science. It's about figuring out, you know, what's actually happening and not caring about people's emotions necessarily. And so what I tried to set out to do with this book is essentially to write an unsentimental book about the most sentimental subject there is. What was really fun for me was, you know, I of course wanted to talk to, you know, people who made movies and people at music labels and people whose ideas had gone viral on the internet or whose books and ideas had gone viral. But I also wanted to talk to the academics, people who are holed up in ivory towers thinking about this stuff and never talking to the movie studios and music labels. And it turned out that they actually had a surprising amount of overlap. Both of them, I think, have realized that even though people want to like new things, we want to tell ourselves we love originality, we actually just like familiarity. We love what we know. And so across the pop culture landscape, you see that some of the biggest hits are often sort of interesting tweaks on the familiar surprises, essentially.
Yeah, and that's a big tension all through your book, the love of the new and the fear of the new and figuring out how to hit that sweet spot where it's familiar enough to me, but not so familiar that it's boring, and new to me, but not so new that it's outside of my framework. That's the big struggle, it seems like, for a lot of creators.
Yeah, that's exactly right. I think you put it perfectly. I think that another way to say it is that people are both neophilic. They love new things. They seek out new things. They want to discover new fashions and ideas. At the same time, they're neophobic. They're afraid of new things. They don't like anything that's too new. If they confront an idea that's too new, they'll just assume that it's wrong. If they hear a piece of music that has nothing to do with the taste they've established, they'll just assume that it's bad. So I think that it's really interesting to think about trying to marry these two ideas. And, you know, one really interesting example, I think, is Spotify and Discover Weekly. Discover Weekly is Spotify's dump of 30 songs every Monday. Initially, the app was supposed to be 30 entirely new songs from bands that users had never heard of. And they were doing some internal testing and accidentally let slip some bands and songs that users had actually heard before. It was accidentally too familiar. And so they fixed the bug and they kept testing it. And engagement with the app after they fixed this bug collapsed. So essentially, just having a little bit of familiarity in this new product, which was essentially a discovery product, made it much, much more popular.
Yeah, and we often hear the cliche of the movie pitch or, you know, oh, it's like Beaches meets Total Recall or something like that.
Right.
It's two familiar things put together in a slightly different way, and that's all it takes a lot of times. As creative as we think we are and as discerning as we think we are, just that a little twist, we're actually kind of predictable when they put these things together.
Yeah, so what's interesting about this is now we're not just talking about psychology. We're really talking about marketing, right? Like you have an incredibly new idea, no one really knows what to do with it. And then you say, oh, well, I'll just give it a high concept pitch, right? Like Airbnb, for example, was struggling to communicate to some people exactly what they were doing. And some people out in Y Combinator in San Francisco said, well, just tell them your eBay for space. And then suddenly, right, consumers understood, oh, okay, eBay for space, got it. You know, when Uber was getting off the ground and Lyft, no one knew what to think of them, and so they were thought of essentially as eBay for cars or Airbnb for cars, right? And now we think of new companies as being Uber for X and Lyft for Y. And so we need, in order to understand a new concept or a new product, a little bit of a hold in something that's already familiar.
Talking to Derek Thompson, his new book is called Hitmakers, The Science of Popularity in an Age of Distraction. So, Derek, here's a familiar maybe movie plot. The genius artist or musician or whatever struggles in obscurity, but they're just so good that inevitably their brilliant stuff comes out and becomes, in one way or another, a hit. That's not really the way it works, is it?
No, yeah, and again, this is one of those sentimental myths that doesn't quite pan out when you talk to the academics. I think that both producers and consumers of culture want to believe that quality is destiny. The producers want to believe that quality is destiny because they want to say, look, if I've written a great book, if I've written a great article or made a great movie, my work is done. I don't have to worry about distribution. The work is self-distributing because of its inherent genius. So believing that quality is destiny in a weird way allows them to be a little bit lazy on the back end. Consumers want to believe the same thing, though, right? We want to think that that there are reasons why our favorite movies and songs are our favorites, that they are in some way the best at doing something that they do. But again and again throughout pop culture history, you see that distribution matters much more for success than the quality of the content itself. You see this with like the Impressionist canon in the first chapter of the book, where you had a bunch of Impressionists who were all sort of equally hated at the time, and then only a handful of them actually hung at the Musée de Luxembourg in the 1890s. And the seven who hung in the Musée de Luxembourg for the first time in the 1890s are still the seven that we consider the best painters. Is it because they were the best? It's hard to say. They are there in the canon now because of the distribution provided by that first French museum.
But we think that things are different now with this idea that things can go viral. All I need to do is spread a thing to some people. They're going to spread it to some other people, and it's just going to just sort of on its own spread out there. You don't completely buy that.
No, I do think, right. So in the book, I talk about the so-called viral myth, this idea that we think that everything that becomes popular is literally going viral. And viral has a very specific definition in epidemiology. Virality means that one person gets sick, Jeff gets sick, and Jeff spreads the disease to two people, and then those two people get sick, and you have many, many, many generations of one to two shares, right? Now, how does stuff go big online? Well, for a long time, people just didn't really know how trends spread. You couldn't literally track exactly how, say, the skinny jean got popular. But online, information always leaves a pixel trail. It leaves a data trail. You can follow the information cascades of tweets and Facebook posts. And if you look at these information cascades, they actually don't look like viruses at all. They look much more like broadcasts. Almost everything that goes big online almost always has one broadcast or 1 to 1,000, 1 to 1 million moment. So again, the viral myth is really sentimental and beautiful. It says that great products, great art is self-distributing. It's just inherently catchy and people just pass it along. But it's just not the case. Distribution, in fact, is significantly more important than content and quality in manufacturing popularity.
So if I'm trying to produce the next hit song or hit movie or whatever, what am I doing in this day and age to try to capture that fake viral nature that actually is broadcast one way or another and is going to catch on?
Right, and right. This is a great question, right? If nothing is self-distributing and popularity on the internet or popularity in markets is dictated by the biggest broadcast, then what do you do? A part of what you do, frankly, is if you are writing a book then you go on Wisconsin Public Radio to talk about it. You understand.
That's the key,
right? Exactly. It's all about you guys. But no, you want to essentially understand that the key is hitting as many broadcast moments as possible, giving yourself as many chances as possible to have those 1 to 1 million moments, rather than essentially saying, look, I've made something that's wonderful. I'm just going to let it catch on in the market. There are lots of like little strategies that are sort of industry specific for essentially saying, you know, if you make a product that if you make a product that's going to be beloved by Seinfeld fanatics, then, you know, scour the internet, look around. Where are Seinfeld fanatics gathering? Are there podcasts that reach thousands of them every single week? Are there blogs where, you know, episodes are being recapped over and over again? Where are essentially the focal points where this community, these cults are sort of gathering around? And then hit those, trigger them. But don't just assume that because Seinfeld's very popular and you write something that's totally delightful about Seinfeld, it's just going to spread like wildfire.
We're talking with Atlantic Magazine editor Derek Thompson about the science of popularity. He says the mega hit movies, songs, and products that skyrocket to success after seemingly coming out of nowhere often have a secret history behind the scenes that explain their success.
You can join in as well at 800-642-1234. What was an example of a popular cultural phenomenon that took you by surprise? How did you try to explain it? And what questions do you have about the science of popularity in the digital age? Join the conversation at 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll pick up the conversation and hear a little bit about luck and the first big rock and roll hit coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We're talking about the science of popularity and why some things hit it big, why some don't, and why we may be more predictable than we'd like to think. Our guest is Derek Thompson, author of the new book, Hitmakers.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think makes something popular? Are you more likely to check something out if it's recommended to you by friends, colleagues, some social network of some sort? How do you discover new movies, songs, TV shows, books? If you've disliked something very popular, why? What was behind that? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. Derek, rock around the clock. Bill Haley and the Comets, first big rock and roll hit. It's one of the many stories you tell in the book. Can you tell us how it went from being an obscure kind of failed B-side to a big hit?
Yeah, I'm so glad you asked. This I think might be my favorite story from the book. And this gets right to the idea that we were last talking about, the idea of quality and destiny. So in 1954, Bill Haley has this song that he really wants to record, and not a lot of labels want to let him rock around the clock. They finally put it to wax and make it the B-side of this other song that's about a hydrogen bomb blowing up, a really wacky song.
Good stuff.
It comes out in 1954, and it's basically a dud. The music label tries to push it out. It gets advertisement in Billboard and Variety, but basically no one really wants to listen to it. So Rock Around the Clock is essentially a failure. The next year, a 10-year-old boy named Peter Ford, who lives in Los Angeles, is one of the several thousand people who buy the Rock Around the Clock album. Peter Ford's dad is Glenn Ford, who is a movie star, who's starring in a movie called Blackboard Jungle, which is sort of like Rebel Without a Cause, a juvenile delinquency film. The director of the film comes over to their house in L.A., and he says, I need a song to kick off this movie about, you know, rambunctious teens. And this 10-year-old boy, Peter Ford, gives the director of the movie a couple of vinyl records, including Rock Around the Clock. The song ends up going into the movie at the beginning of the movie, in the middle, and then at the end. And it's only then, 2 weeks after Blackboard Jungle comes out, that the song becomes the number one song in the country, the first rock and roll song to ever hit number one on Billboard, and the second best-selling song in the history of music. So if you're the sort of person that thinks that the qualities of certain cultural products explain their success, how the heck do you explain Rock Around the Clock? The song sounded the exact same in 1954 and 1955. Like, 9 months elapsed between it being a failure and it being the biggest success in the 1950s and one of the biggest successes in rock and roll history. So you can only explain the difference in these outcomes by pointing to two factors. First, distribution. It came out in a slightly new way in 1955. And second, luck. There are just some products that hit at the right moment, the right time, in the right medium for the right people, and they just basically get lucky. And that's not inspiring to a lot of people. But the antidote to, you know, a world that's probabilistic is volume. If everything that you do has a 10% chance, 15% chance of success, then what you want is to give yourself as many at-bats as possible, right? To give yourself as many rock-around-the-clock opportunities as you can.
Let's go to our callers now at 800-642-1234. Zach is on the line in Green Bay. Zach, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. A little bit of background. I work for a popular rock station here in Green Bay as an on-air radio host. And it seems to be that every time I encounter a new song that we play, it reaches a certain peak of popularity, a certain pinnacle, and it starts to lose its soul. It starts to, you know, get a little commercialized. It's, in my opinion, it starts to be bad. I want to know why that is. I'll take my answer off the air. Thank you,
Zach. I want to ask you: do you think it's just you've heard it so darn many times by then, or is it something about the fact that it is popular now?
I think it's something about the fact that it is popular. I think that once people get, you know, so far into the song or start, you know, a certain number of people start liking or listening to and talking about the song, that they, you know, the bands, they try to recreate that. They try to recreate that popularity in order to sell more product. And, you know, I want to know, well, you know, how did that formula come about? Why is that the way the world is?
Zach, thanks a lot. Derek, what do you think?
Yeah, this is a great point, and I think everyone can empathize with experience. If you imagine, you know, the first time you hear a new song, even by your favorite band in the world, it's not immediately your favorite song. You like it, and then you listen to it again, and you like it a little bit more, and again, and you like it a little bit more. You're beginning to understand how to anticipate its choruses and its grooves, but then it reaches this peak, and then it falls down the other side, so that the graph of your liking the song over time sort of resembles an upside-down U or a bit of a hill. You like it, and then it reaches its sort of shock point. This happens with all sorts of ideas. I mean, it happens with buzzwords. It happens with tropes on television, where for the beginning of the century, the dark male antihero absolutely dominated sort of prestige television, and then people sort of realized that there was a glut of them, and so it became a little bit old hat. I think this is psychologists sometimes call it habituation. You habituate to a certain idea or trope, which means that you get a little bit sick of it, even though familiarity overall seems to increase liking. But the second thing that's really interesting about the comment is about the idea that popularity sends a signal that is separate from the product itself. So to unpack that a little bit, I think there are some people that like Taylor Swift because she's popular, and other people that interpret Taylor Swift's popularity, just her popularity itself, as a signal that she might be dreck or fake, and they're looking for excuses to dislike her. In sociology, this is called popularity as a taste. It means that some people are attracted to things that are popular because they're popular, and other people dislike popular things also because they're popular. And so one thing that happens with songs is that once they hit number one for a month, 2 months, 6 months, inevitably the song will wear out people, and they will associate its popularity with a bit of habituation.
Zach, thanks for that call. We're talking to Derek Thompson about his new book, Hitmakers. Derek, things are different than they were in the time of Rock Around the Clock or the Beatles. You know, back there was a time when you could say everybody's listening to this or watching this, and that wasn't true then, but a big proportion of the public was listening to or watching a particular thing because there weren't that many options. Now we've got a lot to choose from. How has that changed a popularity when we can go to a place and get exactly the kind of thing that appeals to us whenever we want?
Yep, this is a great question. So, I mean, you know, the number of books that have been published worldwide has grown by 7x since 1980. The number of movies made in the United States has grown by 7x since 1980. And the number of scripted television shows on cable networks has grown by about 7 to 8x since 1980. So what you're looking at is just a complete explosion in the sheer amount of content, the potential for, you know, leisure time and culture. So what does this do? You know, over this time, the number of hours in a day didn't grow by 7x. The day's still 24 hours long. So by definition, lots of this stuff is failing. As more and more content enters the market, even if it's a global market, you're going to have a lot more failures. Hollywood, in particular, has responded to the age of abundance, if you allow me to call it that, by essentially saying, look, people don't want to see new movies that are risky, that might be bad. If they're only going to buy four or five tickets, movie tickets a year, as they do in 2006, 2017, then we have to anticipate that they're only going to buy tickets to movies with characters and plots that they recognize. And as a result, the entire business model of Hollywood has reoriented around franchises, around sequels and adaptations and comic book universes. In 1996, none of the top 10 movies were sequels. This year, six of the top 10 were sequels, and I think the only exceptions were animated films. So you have seen an incredibly dramatic shift in the economic model of Hollywood that is a direct response to the age of abundance that you talked about.
Derek, as we wrap up, has looking at how hits are made changed the way you look at the things that you stumble across and listen to and maybe second-guess yourself as to why you're latching onto this trend or song or whatever?
Yeah, two things. First, one of the clear takeaways from my research into the book and hopefully from people reading the book is that familiarity is just an unbelievably powerful drug. And it's not just powerful in music and movies where we want to hear familiar chord structures and see familiar storylines. It's also a really powerful drug in politics. I think for many people, it's pretty clear through the sociological research that whether you're looking at misogyny or racism or the potential to embrace multiculturalism, often what you're looking at is a bias toward the familiar. People who are not familiar with minorities tend to be very skeptical of them. People who grow up in multicultural areas tend to be much more embracing. So what you're looking at overall is just, you know, the incredible seductiveness of familiarity across both culture and politics. And I think that, you know, it behooves people to take a line from, I think it was Abraham Lincoln who said, I don't like that man. I ought to get to know him better.
And that's a great place to leave it. Derek, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you.
We've been talking to Derek Thompson, senior editor at The Atlantic. He writes there about economics and the media. He's the author of the new book we've been talking about, Hitmakers, The Science of Popularity in an Age of Distraction. You can read a little more about that book and share your thoughts over at the Central Time Facebook page.